Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in New York City at the campus of New York University on the south end of campus. And of course, New York is home of the United Nations. So while at the home of the United Nations, on the campus of NYU, why not talk about the League of Nations with a professor from Columbia University? That makes a lot of sense, right? And we are here with Susan Peterson from Columbia, who's written a book called The Guardians, The League of Nations and the Crisis of Empire from Oxford University Press. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So this is really fun for me because I love talking about things that I don't really know much about. The extent of my knowledge about the League of Nations is pretty much that I frame my research in context of the League of Nations because people seem to understand it a little bit. So I say that the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission was like the League of Nations in that it sort of fed into the thing that came after it. And people seem to understand that concept a little bit. But for you, how do you view the League of Nations as an entity? Because I imagine for someone who studies it, it's much more than the international organization that predated the United Nations.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I don't think anyone would study it exclusively for that reason. It's very interesting as a thing in itself. What I think is most interesting about it is how many functions it took on. It was set up in 1919 as a part of the peacemaking process in Paris. So it was actually incorporated into the Treaty of Versailles. So the Covenant of the League of Nations is part of that treaty, and the founding of the organization happens then in 1919. But it turned into something that was kind of more like a whole arena than an actual organization because it has so many different functions. I mean, we think of it as the organization that was charged with keeping the peace after World War I, and of course it didn't do that. So, you know, mostly it's thought of in that context as a kind of a failed experiment. But I think what people forget is that it is innovative in a lot of other areas, that it also is supposed to manage a whole bunch of different kind of transnational problems. So actually, for instance, for you know, the League is quite important in things like broadcasting. I mean, if somebody has to agree on what different states get different bandwidths and what things like they have to agree on things like river traffic and air traffic control as airplane travel develops, stuff like infectious diseases. How do you notify other countries if you have outbreaks of some kind of disease in your territory? And what do you do about refugees? And what do you do about child welfare? And what about traffic in women? And all those sorts of things have end up being kind of thrown at the League because in some cases there are voluntary organizations that are dealing with those, like the Red Cross or something like that. But those end up cooperating with the League, and it becomes a kind of umbrella for doing all kinds of transnational things. And those functions tend to just translate into the UN after the Second World War. They get taken over.
That's really interesting. Is that sort of a process of just the time as well? Like the period where you're having greater exchange economics, particularly with communications, you mentioned, the communications going back and forth across borders. So, you know, this comes up in the context of the First World War, this organization, but as these things expand, it almost seems like something like this would be necessary even if there hadn't been the need following the war.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The period before 1914 is actually a period of quite open trade, economic openness, for instance, and then, of course, all sorts of barriers are imposed and economies are essentially nationalized in the course of the war. So one of the things that happens is there's a lot of economic instability right afterwards. And the largest section, the most important section of the League, in a way, to get started was its economic and financial section because, you know, there's various forms of economic collapse that are going on. So one of the first things the League does is send a bunch of experts essentially to Austria to stabilize the currency. There's a crash almost immediately because these states are the new states are setting up, and they need to have kind of stable banking systems, redone currencies, and so on. So all that kind of planning, you know, it's not only done by the League, but the League works with, say, central bankers, with financial officials from different countries, and it has this, it takes on this kind of coordinating function. Someone has to do that, and often states don't quite know what to do. They kind of throw this towards Geneva, and Geneva provides a kind of framework or an apparatus within which some forms of collaboration can happen. And the 20s are a very complex and kind of fragile period. You know, things have been really, the war has really damaged so many things. I mean, there are huge refugee flows. The war continues after the end of the war with Germany. There's still war going on in Eastern Europe, Russia, and there's a war continues in the former Ottoman Empire for a while. Okay, so all of that creates refugee problems. There's famine in Eastern Europe. There's cholera in Eastern Europe, and the League is one of the bodies that kind of is asked to help coordinate a response. No individual state can do that. And the Americans, even though the Americans don't join the League, and that's actually very debilitating for the League that the Americans don't join. Nevertheless, the Americans, and particularly American organizations, kind of philanthropies and think tanks and that kind of body, they do participate with the League. So something like the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace or the Rockefeller Foundation, they will give money to fund some League projects. They funded the League Health Organization pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a kind of proto-globalization job.
So, I mean, most people, I think, have this idea of the League as being a very ineffectual organization mm-hmm. because of this idea that it's designed to keep peace. And as you mentioned, it didn't really do that.
Right.
But the sense I'm getting is that it was actually much more effective in a lot of other ways, that to look at it as a failure wouldn't be fair.
Yeah, I think that issue of, like, is it fair or not, that's mm-hmm. a kind of complicated and tricky thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think on some level, you know, the single most important thing was not to go to war again. And, of course, you know, Europe did go to war again. So in mm-hmm. that sense, it was, quote-unquote, a failure. But the League is only as effective as the states who are willing to be in it and are willing to commit to it. I think there's a set of fatal flaws in the League's security regime. It was expected, first of all, the fact that the Americans don't join make it possible in ways it wouldn't have been possible for other powers, if they don't get what they want, to just withdraw. So the League has these kind of constant problems of states just, like, taking their toys and going home, which is, you know, what people don't do with the United Nations, what states don't do with the United Nations, because the United Nations is pretty much an all-in organization. But the League, you know, most states join the League, but, you know, Japan leaves over the Manchuria crisis, Germany leaves when Hitler comes to power over disarmament, and Italy leaves over the conquest of Ethiopia, for which it's named an aggressor by the League and has sanctions put on it. And those sorts of occasions bring out this conflict between the League's kind of coercive function and its ability to actually force people to play by the rules and the rhetoric of the League. I mean, the League is supposed to keep the peace, but, you know, it doesn't have an army. It has fluctuating membership. And, you know, so countries pull out, and it relies on a kind of rhetoric of, we're all in this together, and if one state breaks the law, international law, or breaks the rules, we're going to punish them collectively. But nobody thought through what those punishments were all that well. And so, I mean, what they thought is that they could impose sanctions. But sanctions don't necessarily make states change their mind. It depends on how draconian they are, how effective, how they're backed up. So in the case of the Ethiopian, Italo-Ethiopian conflict, sanctions were put on, but they just made Italy more determined to move faster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Italy conquered Ethiopia anyway, and then it withdrew from the league. So that was a kind of a worst case scenario, really. And it did really damage the league. After that, all the crises that happened after that, Spain, German aggression in Munich, in Czechoslovakia, the Munich Accords, things like that, they aren't handled through the league. The case that is handled through the league is this Italian-Ethiopian war. And when that doesn't work, everybody kind of understands that the security operations of the league are not functional.
And it seems to me that that would really speak to the foundation and the structure of the organization. And it's interesting that you talk about countries pulling out and the United States not being a part of it. Because one of the things I think a lot of people would have this conception of, or the, perhaps the thing that they best remember about Woodrow Wilson, is the 14 points for peace and all this. And one of my favorite cartoons that I've ever seen, and I still have it, it's Woodrow Wilson, and he's in heaven, and he's talking to God. And God says, Woodrow Wilson, what happened to your 14 points? And Wilson says, don't worry, God, we didn't follow your 10 commandments either. So in terms of that, I mean, what was the core flaw in the organizational structure that allowed that? Was it simply that this is a new organization, we're not really sure the most effective way to set it up? Or was there reluctance on people to buy in?
I mean, I think you can point to a certain kind of naivete. Some of the greatest supporters of the league, like Lord Robert Cecil, who's one of the people who draft the covenant of the league, look back and years later and they said, well, we were a bit, you know, sanguine to and not really entirely practical about the need to be able to have some form of force to back up these kinds of sanctions. So they do look back to that. But I really think if you also look at the time, three things are real problems. First, the fact that the United States doesn't join. That is a huge problem because the United States is inheriting this role as the greatest power. And if it's not going to pay attention and use its influence, the whole kind of operation is going to be harmed by that. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. The second problem is that the league was tied formally to the Treaty of Versailles, which means the loser states or states that are grumbling about the treaty are constantly badgering the league. They're always saying that they're not equal partners. You have to do this, you have to do that. That's particularly Germany, mm-hmm. of course. Yeah. So that's a huge problem as well. And it's not clear what could be done about that. That's a function of the sort of destabilizing role of Germany in the world mm-hmm. system in the interwar years, not purely the league. And then the league is also hit by the Depression. I mean, actually, quite a lot of work is done in the mid-20s. This is, I don't know if you recall these, but this is the moment of Locarno. There are these treaties that are worked out that stabilize basically the Western powers. So the most important thing is that France and Germany and Britain basically come to agreement, and Germany accepts the Western borders, and Germany is brought into the league. And for that period then, around the mid to late 20s, there's a real period of optimism. People call that the spirit of Locarno. You know, Gustav Stresemann was Chancellor of Germany at the time. He was very effective. He came to, like, every meeting of the Assembly and the League Council, mm-hmm. and Aristide Briand for France came, and the Foreign Secretary of Britain came. And those meetings also built a kind of measure of trust, or at least minimal agreement among these states. The problem is, you know, the depression comes at the end of the 20s, and it's so damaging, and all states kind of fall back on national interest, partly to cope with the effects of the depression. And so it's kind of a combination of things that the League can't really effectively work against. The economic section of the League continued to say, we're going to worsen not just our, not just economic prospects, international economic prospects, but also security if we move in the direction of slapping on, if every state starts slapping on tariffs as a response to depression. And so they kept trying to get states not to move in that direction, but states always looked at their immediate interest in this terrible economic plight they found themselves in and did move in the direction of tariffs. And as was predicted, that was another blow to kind of international cooperation. So, you know, the combination of like economic, rising economic nationalism and then rising territorial nationalism in the 30s, it's very unclear what the League could have done to really combat that, particularly once these revisionist states, they just pull out. Right. You know, Japan's gone, Germany's gone, and then Italy's gone, and the U.S. is not there. And when it's just a collection of Britain and France, and it's, you know, yeah, and small states, it can do some of those kind of technical functions, which are quite important, but it cannot keep the peace because it doesn't, everybody's not in the room anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. It seems as though in, when there's poor economic times and an increase in militarism, or at least the potential of military conflict, that's when countries are going to be most looking out for themselves.
Right.
Right. And that sort of self-preservation ideology would then inhibit international cooperation. I mean, that's just clear, right?
Like, yeah. That's right. That's exactly what happened. Right. And instead, what you get in the late 30s is, you know, revisionist powers like Germany are trying to create alternative blocks. They're trying to kind of pull other states into satellite arrangements with them, preparing, you know, Hitler is apparently preparing for war.
Right.
And the League then just becomes this kind of alliance. It's not a military alliance. It's supposed to be universal. And actually, it's interesting because, for instance, all the Latin American states, almost all of them join. But in the late 30s, they also start pulling out. It's like, why are we part of this? It isn't delivering what we need anymore, right?
Right. Again, that's self-interest, too. It's that we're not getting what we need out of it.
Right,
and,
right.
Yeah. So you mentioned, though, that the League of Nations was tied to the treaty in 1919. Was entry bound on, like, if you signed the treaty, are you in the League?
Yes. For the founder members, yes. Though Germany is barred from the League until these negotiations happen. The French do not want the Germans in the League immediately. There's this kind of sense that the Germans have to prove themselves to be a respectable state again.
So it wasn't enough just to, like, destroy their economy? And
no. I mean, it is more that, you know, It's more than one could imagine that after a war that's cost millions and millions of lives, everybody's just going to say, like, now we're friends. I mean,
isn't it almost counterintuitive to say, okay, yes, you're deemed responsible for this conflict, but to completely isolate them and bar them from participation, would that not just foster more resentment?
Well, I think
at the time, it seems as though that...
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of... This was a subject of, like, ongoing conflict between the British and the French.
Okay.
From the French perspective, the French lost about 1.4 million men in the First World War. Germany was more responsible than France for that war. And so the French feel, whatever it is we do, we have to prevent Germany from ever being able to do something like this again. The problem is the peace was an in-between peace, right? It neither completely broke Germany, which the, you know, World War II, the armies meet in Germany. Mm-hmm. World War I, Germany is never occupied, really. Right. It's never shattered in the same way. You know, and Germany sues for peace, for an armistice on the basis of the 14 points. It doesn't capitulate completely, right? So there's this discomfort about the peace. And the British are always trying to say, like, we've got to rehabilitate Germany. And the French are always trying to say, like, we've got to make sure that they're militarily not capable of doing this again. So there isn't even very, you know, there's supposed to be complete agreement between Britain and France, but even that breaks down.
Right. And I guess you could see the French point perspective.
Absolutely,
right?
You, like, can see the French perspective, like, yeah.
You know, it might seem vengeful,
right,
but it seems as if it could be also a very natural response to what happened.
I think everyone felt vengeful in 1918. The elections that happened right after the war, I mean, the British election was fought on kind of hang the Kaiser, you know. you know, I mean, people really, there's incredible war weariness, but there's also some amount of kind of just vengefulness, yeah. But what is interesting to me is how much support there is for organizations like the League of Nations. I mean, now, when you think of the United Nations does all kinds of really important things, but it's not a popular cause. It's not like people are rushing out to join. There is a United Nations organization. You can join it. But, you know, it doesn't have masses of members. But in the interwar years, I mean, this was particularly true of Britain, but there was a League of Nations union that had thousands of chapters. 400,000 people were members of the League of Nations union. Individual people who, like, went out and joined, and they would do things, you know, like sell copies of the covenant and have little study circles and go and, you know, make sure that the curriculum in the schools taught internationalism and peace. And, you know, it was a real popular cause. Mm-hmm. And so I think the kind of disappointment about the failures of the League really hit home, because hopes were really high. And some of those were unrealistic, sure, but it's also, it was a real cause.
And that makes sense, because if we think about it in at least the Canadian context, mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about the 1920s, there's all sorts of memorials put up. Every small town has something, whether it's a cenotaph, an arena, school that's named either memorial for the war or specific to that town's contribution to the First World War. And people were aware of how bad it was, particularly when soldiers start coming back and tell stories, and people are more aware of what's going on. So this sense of let's not let this happen again would draw people to an organization like this and go to try and go out and preach these ideas.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I should say, you know, my book is not on the League per se. Mm-hmm. It's on really one part of its its job, which was kind of the job of managing the imperial settlement at the end of the war, because a lot of territories changed hands in the First World War. So it's about the mandates regime, which is a kind of oversight regime for those territories that changed hands in the Pacific and Africa and the Middle East. Right. But the League itself, the whole subject of the League of Nations. I mean, one of the things I find really interesting about this, and I think it's because of the moment we're at right now, you know, it's an interesting moment. You can see there are these huge issues that clearly can't be solved by a single state. Climate change, you know. You know, the economies are incredibly intertwined.
Right. Refugees.
I mean, those sorts of issues. And so partly because of that, I think people are going back to the history of internationalism and the history of international organizations. So when I started working on this, you know, the League of Nations archive, it's in Geneva. It was like this little room on the second floor with this woman who sat at a desk, and she was the archivist. And then there were four little tables with about, you could put about five researchers in there. And it was great. I mean, I didn't mind working in those conditions. You know, they had all the boxes in. But it got busier and busier, and now they've moved into new quarters. And more, when I kind of do work on this subject, it's become a kind of growth industry. There are all these graduate students doing dissertations on this subject. I mean, on various aspects of the league, like say something like traffic in women, you know, or the work of the secretariat. I mean, right. One of the most innovative things about the league is that it created an international bureaucracy, right? And one friend of mine teased me about my book because he said, this is one of the few books that has like heroic bureaucrats. Your main characters are these guys who are actually just like officials, right? But I think it is interesting. You know, when the league was planned, the guy who first was supposed to be the secretary general, the first secretary general, who was the British cabinet secretary, Sir Maurice Hankey, planned the secretariat first. And he thought it would just be cabinets of different national representatives. They would bring, officials would be seconded from national administrations. Mm-hmm. So the British Undersecretary General would bring his own staff, and the French would bring his, right. and the German would bring his, and the American would bring his, etc. So there wasn't going to be, there was going to be a kind of small-scale international secretariat who would be things like, you know, translators and clerks and librarians and so on.
Right.
But he didn't think it would be a real international officialdom. But in the end, the guy who was appointed, because Hankey then spent some time thinking about it, decided he didn't want the job. He'd rather continue to be cabinet secretary and head of the Committee of Imperial Defense, because he concluded that the British Empire was a big deal and the League was going to be small potatoes in comparison. So he'd rather stay with the British Empire. So the guy who got the job instead was a career Foreign Office official, Sir Eric Drummond. And Drummond is like not a very imaginative guy, but he has this like one moment of imagination, which is when he's setting up the secretariat, and he decided it shouldn't be set up by nation, it should be set up by function. And so there's a mandate section, and there's a minorities section, and there's a press section, and a legal section, and a political section, and a health section, and a social section that deals with things like child welfare, and then the staff is hired from the nationals of any countries that are members of the league, mm-hmm. provided they can work in English and French, and that secretariat, they have to take oaths of loyalty to the covenant of the league,
okay.
not to their national state. And they're supposed to be loyal then to an international organization. Now, of course, foreign ministries immediately say, like, we need to know what's going on in Geneva. So they're always trying to find out. So there's a lot of spying and, like, under the counter sharing of information,
mm-hmm.
but actually it's an incredibly imaginative thing to do, and you end up with a group of officials who work together who are defined by their loyalty to, they're not always completely loyal, but formal loyalty to an international organization, which is, and that's the structure that carries on. That's probably right. The single most important thing about the league is that the UN replicates that structure completely.
Because it seems like that would be a much more collaborative way to do it rather than bringing in people based on nationality.
Right.
Right. To find the topic or the subject that we're working on and then bring people in based on
yes.
the topic. And then everyone works together. I mean, that's really the point. And if you were yes. doing it by nationality, it seems as though that could really separate people a little bit more.
Yes. I mean, that's how you would do it if it's basically an adjunct to a great power diplomacy system, right? If it's
right.
kind of like a 100-year later equivalent of the Congress of Vienna or
right.
something like that, where you get the great powers together and they have staffs, and then you come to agreements, and then maybe you have some bureaucrats to implement or something like that. But that's a very different model from saying you're going to identify a set of things that are common problems
right.
to the, that are, you know, the economic section, the disarmament section. I mean, these were the kind of sections of the League Secretariat,
mm-hmm.
and those are then supposed to take on those issues for kind of the interest of the world as a whole.
Right.
Now, whether they're actually capable of doing that depends, you know.
Sure.
I mean, there are always problems of dealing with individual states, plus they never have enough money, plus, you know, there's all these sorts of problems. But nevertheless, as a bureaucracy, I think it's very, very creative, very interesting. And that's, I think, partly what is generating the research interest, because all kinds of things end up going to Geneva because there's no other place that has the capacity to handle international questions or transnational questions like that.
And as we continue to move towards transnational history as a trend, people start getting into that. And just in day-to-day living, we live in a more global environment increasingly. So it seems as though this sort of research becomes more and more relevant to a contemporary audience. You mentioned the finances, that there was never any money. So how was this thing supposed to be funded?
They're not completely poor, and they're funded the way the UN is funded. Mm-hmm. There are dues on individual member states.
Right. Did people pay them?
People do on the whole. I mean, they're heavily dependent on the British and the French, obviously. Right. But interestingly, and the Secretariat is not that big. There's 700, at its height, there's about 700 members working in Geneva for the League Secretariat. And
they're also in Geneva, which is very expensive.
Well, it's very expensive now.
I don't know if it was
then. It wasn't so expensive then.
Okay.
But one of the things I know Geneva's a complete nightmare. I've spent so much time there doing research, and it is so expensive. But one of the things that Drummond insists on, actually, is that the League pay quite good salaries. Mm-hmm. The League Secretariat paid well. And so people really wanted to get jobs at the League. And particularly in the early days, Drummond makes very creative appointments. He's got some very talented people working for him. And interestingly, if you work on things like international relations or something like that, all kinds of smart people pass through Geneva working for the Secretariat at some point. It's a good place to be. But for money, the other thing that is surprising is that some amount of the work of the organization isn't actually done really by the officials of the organization. I mean, take for instance, there was one woman who was the head of a section, which is kind of the top of the official ladder. So she's head of the social section, which is one of which you could predict. That'll go to a woman. It goes to a British woman. It's Rachel Crowdy, who had organized nursing in the First World War. And what falls under her is child welfare and trafficking and kind of women's issues and things like that. And she kind of realized that with this tiny staff, she wasn't going to be able to do anything, but she has these very good contacts to all these international and humanitarian and women's organizations. So she has these committees that are supposed to be advisory committees, but she allows those kind of philanthropic and voluntary organizations to have what are called assessors. They can sit on League bodies.
Okay.
And so there's this kind of movement of sort of philanthropic and humanitarian organizations into providing some of the legwork for the League. So they're quite heavily involved. Some of them then set up offices in Geneva so they can be close to the League and kind of do. So the League profits from that. The other thing that is very interesting is that the League health section, which is very innovative and important, gets about half its budget by the 30s from American philanthropies. Carnegie and Rockefeller, they give very large amounts of money to support the kind of international health work of the League. League is doing things like they set up offices to track infectious disease. So they're doing the beginnings of kind of international public health work. And even though the U.S. isn't a member, American internationalists, people like actually my university, Columbia, was full of people who were tied into the League. James Shotwell, who was a professor at Columbia, was also the head of the Carnegie Endowment and was also would go to every League assembly. And people like that make sure that there's a continued American input, including American financial support for the League.
So even if there's not official government participation, there is some form of contribution from the United States.
Yeah, the U.S. was important. I mean, the U.S. is lucky. You know, it has the advantage of being powerful. So it isn't fair, but the U.S. is the one state that kind of gets to choose what it's involved in.
Right.
So it's not involved in a lot of stuff, but the, you know, British head of the league, the Secretary General, he is so desperate to try and bring the Americans in that anything that he can do to kind of continue to cultivate Americans, he does. There are Americans working at the Secretariat, though formally they shouldn't really be working at the Secretariat because the U.S. isn't a member. Mm-hmm. But they are. There's a half a dozen Americans in relatively important positions within the Secretariat.
Oh, wow. So it clearly is a priority then to have some American inclusion. And one of the things that I'm interested to talk about as well is, you mentioned it before, but this mandate system,
right,
which is something that I'm not overly familiar with, being a someone who studies Canadian broadcasting. I'm not overly familiar with mandates. So just quickly, if you could explain what the mandate system is.
Yes, sure. People kind of forget that Germany had an empire, right? But they did.
Yeah.
They held German East Africa, which was Tanganyika and Burundi and Rwanda. And they held Cameroon, and they held Togo, and they held Southwest Africa, portions of New Guinea, and the Bismarck Archipelago, and Western Samoa, and the Mariana and Caroline and Marshall Islands in the Pacific. It's a not inconsiderable pile of territory.
That's a pretty big space spread out over a wide swath of land.
And then, of course, the Ottoman Empire wasn't just Turkey. The Ottoman Empire also held much of the Middle East.
Right.
Okay, so in the war, part of what happens is that those territories fall to the Allies. Okay, one of the first things that happens in the war is that those German territories are taken over, okay? And that's kind of, they're not really defensible by Germany because, you know, the ones in Africa are surrounded by Allied colonies. Mm-hmm. And the Pacific, I mean, the Australians and the New Zealanders just go and grab the German, they grab Western Samoa and New Guinea immediately, and the Japanese send ships down and take everything north of the equator. Mm-hmm. So those territories change hands. And initially, and in Africa too, the Belgians and the French and the British take over all the German colonies. Mm-hmm. Some of those campaigns are, the one campaign that lasts for the whole of the war is the campaign in German East Africa, which is now Tanzania and Rwanda and Burundi. I think people forget, in spite of all this, like, commemoration of World War One, people forget the war in Africa, and they forget how devastating it was for Africans.
Right.
Africans were impressed as porters by both sides. There were unbelievably high death rates. Tanganyika just went back to bush, and things like disease and famine were rife across East Africa as a result of this war that lasted actually the whole of the war. It was a mobile war with this German general who just kept marching around in East Africa, being kind of harried by these South African and British troops. So it was, and, you know, most of the actual fighting and the actual war, including all the support for it, is done by African troops. And so it's really a devastating experience. So anyway, all those territories change hands. And given the mood the Allies are in at the end of the war, they all want to keep them. Right?
Sure.
They just want to keep them. But Woodrow Wilson has said, I mean, it's one of the, you know, main planks is no annexations, right? A peace without annexations or indemnities. And so there's this huge fight that happens at the peace conference over whether these territories can simply be annexed by the powers that conquered them.
Right.
And the agreement is that they can't be. And that's a kind of agreement that the British mostly broker. And instead they agree that they will be held in trust under mandate from the League of Nations.
Okay.
And so these texts are written up that specify how they're supposed to be governed, and then this commission is set up in Geneva that's supposed to watch out to see that these promises are fulfilled.
Okay.
So that's the mandate system.
Okay.
And, you know, the whole thing is agreed to partly because there's this huge anti-colonial wave going on at the end of the war. So, you know, the Allies are in trouble anyway because of that. And then because of Wilson's insistence. But, you know, then the U.S. doesn't join. And so it's clear that most of these countries are just hoping that the whole thing will go away.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, the League is set up. And so, I mean, this is basically what the book is about. The kind of officials in Geneva start setting this apparatus up. And bit by bit, there's a whole series of scandals that happen in different mandated territories. You know, they first one's in Southwest Africa, then Syria, then there's one in Samoa. And those kind of blow up as public events in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they hit the news. Right. And all of a sudden, and so what ends up, league oversight doesn't actually prove to be very different as a way of governing colonies. What it does is it proves to be a kind of system for propagandizing what's going on.
Right.
And so publicity kind of takes off about particular scandals, about mm-hmm. particular issues. The league gets involved in that. And so bit by bit, through many, many different changes, the mandate system is a kind of space in which an argument over what empire is supposed to be and look like takes place.
Okay.
Right? Because of mm-hmm. the publicity functions of the league,
yep.
and it becomes very acrimonious. And bizarrely, that period when Germany is a member of the league, the Germans push that argument a lot because, of course, they're so angry that they had to relinquish their colonies. There's a local German movement that is trying to reclaim colonies all through mm-hmm. the interwar years. And so later in the Nazi period, that just becomes a territorial movement where they try and reclaim, you know, they want their colonies back.
Sure.
But in the period of Weimar, where Stresemann's in charge, that's not what he's after. Instead, mm-hmm. what he's really after is that these promises that these territories will be governed in the interests of all,
mm-hmm.
right? That first of all, they'll be governed humanely or something like that. But the Germans are more concerned that they will be governed with rules about equal access for all league states.
Right.
They want their trade to be able to get back in and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so the Germans, bizarrely, are the ones who push more than anyone else in the late 20s to essentially say that these territories are not colonies,
mm-hmm.
that empires are not sovereign within them. So you start getting the articulation of something that looks like kind of a movement towards independence almost.
Right.
And so I was most interested. I mean, what I do with the book is track that. And tracking that involved trying to figure out what's going on in a whole slew of different places. So that was it was a really complicated research project.
Sure.
But very interesting. But also does end up showing kind of how this process of international oversight just becomes too contentious. Mm-hmm. And the local states want independence,
mm-hmm.
and the imperial powers end up feeling like, in some cases, perhaps independence is less trouble. A client state.
Sure.
A client state is less trouble than a territory that you have to govern with some bunch of busybody know-it-alls in Geneva overseeing everything you do. And there was also a petition process that was written into this. It wasn't actually planned initially, but there was so much protest coming from the different territories that a petition process got set up. That's actually interesting. That's another thing that translates to the UN. So if you live in a mandated territory and you feel that your rights, which are laid out in these mandates, even though this is so ineffective, I mean, doing this is not going to get you redress, that's for sure. But people petition, and national movements petition. There's this completely hysterical movement in Western Samoa that is the most effective. I mean, 90% of Western Samoan men sign a petition to the League to ask to be relieved of the rule of New Zealand.
Okay.
Which is a pretty high number.
Yes, that is a lot. That is quite high.
So, you know, it's very interesting. And the league, it isn't going to say, yes, of course, you know, it just doesn't say that.
Right.
The premise of the system is that these mandates have been allocated to particular powers.
Right.
Right.
But that's where it seems like something is not meshing in my head, that because you say there's this anti-colonial mentality, yet this sounds a lot like colonialism.
Yes.
Right? Especially when you think of it in a lot of contexts, there's a racial element
yes.
of it's France and Britain, primarily white nations, going into, especially in Africa.
Yes.
Right? That there's a racial dynamic at play here. It seems a lot like colonialism.
It is. It absolutely yeah. is. I mean, when the powers, when the imperial powers agree to this, they agree to it thinking this is a way to protect their empires.
Right.
That this is it'll give them good publicity. They'll be seen as humane empires. This is about standard setting for imperial rule.
Okay.
So they're always dumping on, like, the Portuguese and going on right. about forced labor in Portuguese colonies, you know, and there's this kind of expectation that there will be a better kind of colonialism. What happens, of course, is that the local people end up petitioning the League against that and exposing cases of, like, maladministration. I mean, Syria's a very extreme case. The French face a rising in 1925 in Syria that spreads throughout the whole of the country. In the end, it's put down by the French army. They bomb Damascus, and that creates just this shock, really, around the world. Actual anti-colonialism is very small as a very small force in the within the imperial
sure.
powers.
Right.
It just is.
Right.
But there is absolutely the development of a kind of anti-colonial internationalism with information sharing. And, I mean, I became very interested in... One thing I'm very interested in is there's a group of African-American political scientists and intellectuals who are largely at Howard University in the U.S., they get very interested in the mandate system. A couple mm-hmm. of them write some of the early works on it. And Ralph Bunche writes, who's getting his PhD in the 30s at Harvard and is teaching at Howard University at the same time. Howard University is the most eminent of the historically black colleges.
Okay.
And so it has this very amazing faculty. So he writes his dissertation on whether the oversight of the League is making a difference in colonial administration in West Africa. And he goes to West Africa and gets documents and talks to people and looks around, and he concludes maybe a little bit on the margin, but actually it's some larger changes are necessary. What's really interesting is that he ends up being the head of the Trusteeship Council, which is the successor organization in the United Nations to the League's mandate system.
Oh, okay.
So after 1945, it's kind of his job to transition these areas to independence, right?
Oh, wow.
To turn these, to plan a roadmap to independence. The mandate system didn't really talk much about independence. The only territory that became quote-unquote independent was Iraq. And that happened in 1932, and it's an odd kind of independence because the British remain in charge of, well, the RAF continues to provide quote-unquote defense for Iraq, and British oil companies continue to control oil fields in Iraq. So it's a kind of clientelism.
Right.
Patron-client relations.
Right. It's almost like we'll take the stuff that we want, and then you can deal with the sort of day-to-day.
It's a bit like that. I mean, they have a historic arrangement with the person who is set up as king of Iraq, who is Faisal, who was the leader of the Arab revolt in the First World War.
Okay.
So, and he's supported by the British in that, and so Faisal becomes the first king of Iraq.
Okay.
But except for Iraq, no mandated territory becomes independent. But then the Middle East territories become independent during or after the Second World War, right? And then the rest of the territories are taken over by the United Nations trusteeship system. Mm-hmm. And Bunche ends up being the head of that trusteeship system. And the plan is more explicitly that this has to provide a roadmap to independence.
Okay.
So the UN system is rather different from the League system, but it is a successor to the League system.
Okay. Because you do see a lot of independent countries come after the Second World War.
Yes.
Even in, say, the Caribbean, you have that whole independence movement through the Caribbean that happens as well. So,
you
know, if there's this notion through the League of Nations period that these sentiments are building up.
I think that it's kind of like that, but not really like that, because it's more that the League it's more a question of unintended consequences.
Okay.
Right? The aim for the Allied powers is to set up a system that will preserve and improve imperial rule.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But what happens is that the mechanism of the League provides so much publicity and so much contention that it actually undermines imperial rule and sort of provides a forum for claims to self-determination.
Okay. So that's actually quite interesting, right?
I found it a really interesting project to do because it was kind of constantly surprising. And I had to find out about a lot of... I mean, it certainly tested my capacity to do this kind of thing as a historian because it was a lot of areas that I didn't know that much about. I had to learn about them. I did a lot of travel. I did a lot of research all over the place. I tried to learn new fields.
Nice.
And that was very rewarding. I have to say it was a completely fun project to do, but it took me 10 years. So I feel like it was a big project.
Yes. Yeah. So. Now, we talked before we turned the microphone on, and you alluded to it a little bit, that there's this interest now in these global organizations. And just in terms of the way the United Nations is structured, I mean, we don't need to necessarily talk about the way it operates because certainly people have their issues with the way it operates.
Sure.
But one of the things that I'm most curious about is the Security Council and the addition of this Security Council with permanent members on it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times when you read at least the American media, people are critical of the United Nations in part because of the Security Council and this notion that, well, you'll never get certain things through because of Russia. Right? So this idea. So I'm just curious, how much did the League of Nations experience, do you think, contribute to this idea of having a Security Council, particularly with permanent bodies? And because I'm wondering, too, if the American refusal to join the League of Nations would have contributed to having the United States as a permanent member.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the League Council met about 3 or 4 times a year as a rule. It met more frequently when there were crises of some kind or other. And it actually is quite like the Security Council in that there are also permanent members.
Okay.
So Britain, France, Italy, Germany, when Germany joins, the U.S. was supposed to be, and Japan are permanent members. And then there's a kind of huge fight over who else is going to be on it. Because part of the difficulty, unlike now, where there's 200 states in the world, right, then there were about 50. The League of Nations has a membership of in the 40s for most of its existence. Okay? So no one wants to be the state not on the council.
Right.
Right? So there's this incredibly painful set of agreements that are worked out that there'll be one Scandinavian country, one of the dominions, not all of the dominions, one of this. And so there are these constant arguments about this. And some states very much want to be on all the time. Poland is very, very anxious to be on the League Council all the time. And it ends up being treated as a kind of semi-permanent member because obviously the Poles are very worried, particularly once the Germans come back in, of having any threat to their sovereignty. So what's different about the Council and about the Security Council is I think that the UN, when it was set up with a greater understanding of how much damage it would do the organization if people simply packed their bags and went home.
Right.
So having permanent members of the Security Council, more importantly, allowing a veto on the Security Council, the fact that you can't get things through because Russia will veto or Britain will veto or the U.S. will veto or somebody will veto, right? That veto power is actually a kind of sort of realistic acknowledgement of the fact that the most powerful states will only join if they are able to protect their interests. And the damage done by them simply not joining is so significant. I mean, it's kind of this constant struggle. You want to build up the transnational aspects and the stake that every state has in the league or now in the United Nations, enough that when it comes to thinking about their interests, states will say, well, we don't like that so much, but maybe we should let it go because we get all these other things out of it. Or right. maybe we should, you know, that it right. will affect their calculations a little bit, mm. right?
It might be a tool to compromise.
Yes. And I think the understanding was the value of having the most powerful states in was so great that there just was too much of a risk.
Right.
It was all right to give more acknowledgement to that. The United Nations, interestingly enough, that's why I don't think you can't see the League as kind of exclusively as a predecessor for the UN. It's rather different. It's more internationalist in its presuppositions.
Mm-hmm.
Like the League turned on unanimity, right? Right. Everybody had to agree.
Sure.
If you didn't agree, yep. you withdrew.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So it is more internationalist. The United Nations is more realist. It acknowledges the reality of state power more.
So I guess my last question, I think you sort of answered it a little bit, was going to be, I mean, is the League's ultimate legacy as a body that informed the establishment of the United Nations, which from your last answer, I'm guessing you would say no, that there's much more to it than that.
I think it does do that, and certainly some aspects of how the UN was set up are shaped by the League, so like the Secretariat and a lot of the technical organizations, but also shaped against the League, like the fact that it has a veto.
Right.
At the Security Council, that the permanent members have veto power at the Security Council. So that's different. But I think there's another kind of successor organization. We don't think of that, but the other successor organization is probably the European Union.
Okay.
I mean, because at the point where the League was in operation, most states were European states.
Right.
Right? There are these Latin American members, but the Latin American members don't play as major a role. The European states play a major role, and the what were called non-political, they're political in other ways, but the non-political issues being addressed, like refugees or things like that, were mostly European issues at that point. That's what, and things like economic policy and stuff, those things were picked up by the EU more than, or as much as by the UN. So that's another successor in a way.
Okay. And I guess just as a technical point, is the League of Nations officially gone once war is declared in 1939?
No. It's there's a great transition story.
Okay.
And a few people have actually paid attention to it. So the second Secretary General of the League, I'm trying to remember exactly when he took over, but I think 33, is Joseph Avenel. And the first Secretary General was this understated British guy. The second one, there had been an agreement that it was supposed to be a Frenchman. And the Deputy Secretary General, the French Deputy Secretary General, was Jean Monnet initially, who is like the founder of the European Union. He would have been a brilliant successor. But I don't know whether because he couldn't really get on that well with Drummond or he didn't like the way the thing was developing, the excuse he gave is that the family wine business was falling apart and he had to go and rescue it. So he has to go and like take up the family wine business. So he pulls out of the League in the early 20s and they get this guy instead who's a financial expert named Joseph Avenel. Avenel is a disastrous head of the League and he's also Secretary General during this period where it's hit by one incredible international crisis after another. So he's terrible. So, and he actually starts thinking, he's quite right-wing. He shifts further rightwards when the war breaks out. They're sitting in Geneva, and he thinks maybe the League, after the fall of France, maybe the League should just be we should kind of turn the organization over to, like, Franco-German fascist service. And that never happens because of a kind of, he's already let like 90% of the staff go. But there are a few staff members who really prevent it. They ally with a kind of control board that's sitting in London and they prevent it. And there's a third secretary general who then is appointed, this Irishman named Sean Lester, who doesn't really want to be spending the war in Geneva. He can't get out. It's surrounded. They're worried all the time that they're overstaying their welcome. The Swiss don't like the League sitting there, because it's now identified as a kind of allied resistance sort of organization almost. But he stays there through the whole of the war. They keep a kind of low level of activity. They act basically as a post box. In, I forget the month, but the economic section, they load all the files into cars and they drive for the Pyrenees before the, you know, 1940, I think it is. And they, Princeton takes over the economic section. They're given housing at the Institute for Advanced Study and they work there for the course of the war. Some of the other technical organizations also go to the U.S. or somewhere else. So there is a kind of transition. And then there's a final assembly of the League, which is a tiny affair. It's just people come back to dissolve the organization after the war, wrap it up, and turn its assets over to the U.N. And so that happens. But at the conference, at the U.N. founding conference in San Francisco, nobody wants to talk about the League. Because it's seen as a failure.
Right.
So they're actually quite mean about Lester, who's a very honorable guy and's been holding this thing together. He does get invited, but, like, no one wants to pay any attention to, you know? It's like everybody's going out of their way to say, like, we're not the League of Nations.
Right.
So it took a while for people to realize the extent of the ties. But if you look at who's working, say, at the UN...
Uh-huh.
Not at the very, very top, right? They don't want to bring the absolute top. But you go one level down, and people who ran, who were active in the secretariat, usually make their way to some other international body.
Right. Poor guy, he wouldn't have been able to, ate lunch by himself the whole time.
Like, yeah, well, he's there with, like, a couple of other people, and they stick them in the back row, you know? It's like, you know, we won't pay attention to you, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific story, and I think you've highlighted just in our conversation here how it's more than I think what a lot of people think of it as this failed organization that was a predecessor to the UN, so much more than that. So I would encourage everybody to pick up the book. It's The Guardians, The League of Nations, and The Crisis of Empire by Susan Peterson from Columbia University. It's an Oxford University Press book. It's fresh off the presses, too.
So
we encourage everyone to check it out. And Susan Peterson, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.